Okay, just a few ground rules. We're very limited in time. Obviously, we do not have as much time as we'd like. At least one of the members of the panel has to be on the west side by 1 o'clock, so we're going to have to be somewhat tight with the schedule. Therefore, I ask people to limit their comments to questions rather than comments in order that we can move things as quickly as possible.
It's my observation, I hope this is accurate, that the Hess game is not used in the yeshiva world. Is this because of Yashi's legend of Shash, or is this because of the Natchez syndrome, or is this because of some sort of general antipathy in the reaction to the so-called feminist movement?
Said a question to a mic. Why should I repeat? Was that audible? Not even with the mic? Who heard the question? Say it again. Talk into the mic.
It is my observation that the Yeshivish world does not accuse the Heskin basically. Is this because of a not invented here syndrome? Is it because they're associated for the alleged shots of Rabbi Yashi? Or is there some reporting that the Haredi world is a general antipathy toward women in these matters as a reaction to feminism?
It's not for me to comment on the attitude of others. I can only quote what was quoted to me. I made a brief reference to it in my earlier presentation. I'd like to first begin with an apology. The brief discussion I had about Asmachta failed to go into the fundamentals of the various opinions of the Gemaras and the Rishon of what Asmachta even is. I assume that whoever wanted to follow me knew what it was. Asmachta is a contingency obligation. Some of it involving an exaggeration. Again, like even now I can't go into detail, but I should have mentioned that in my earlier remarks. My belief is that the average member of the community to which you refer is not at all clued into any of the intricacies of Asmachta. Yes, no, that's not the point. The point is perhaps a resistance to change. Which the community that you refer to has a significant measure of. I do not believe that this resistance to change is insurmountable. One of the rabbis I spoke to said that he doesn't think it's going to happen in his lifetime. He may be correct, but you know, funnier things have happened. It's hard for me to infiltrate, if I use that expression, a different community to rile up the troops, you know? I think the only way it's going to work in that community is if the women get up and say enough. And the women control every community, no matter what you say. That's the reality.
Yes. Okay.
I was wondering to touch on a few things we talked about this morning. Can we not be starting younger? Because if we start at college age, then there's always the concern that you're questioning the person you're choosing. I'm talking about starting middle school, so that the way our kids grow up thinking that, they know, kind of they have a sense of what they're looking for, or the kind of wedding they're going to have, they should know that a few days before they get married, they go to something, and that should be part of our education system. I also was wondering, in terms of Rabbi Roy, the question when Rabbi Henkin retracted is the idea of initiating of signing a get pre-wedding, and he said in Israel it could work because he's doing it in a Rabbi, he's doing it in time of Rabbi. Well, I would say even here they're doing it. They love that wife then, even if there is intimacy afterwards, and they're doing it out of love for the wife, and I'm wondering whether that couldn't be possible. And then the final question, and I'm possibly unfair, but I'm wondering whether, in terms of educating, we talked about only 350 rabbis responding, and only 200 saying that they encourage or demand a prenup, whether the idea of prenup and the result of not having a prenup should not, being the recalcitrant husband, the Arana, whatever you want to call it, should not be front and foremost in the RCA's agenda, because we know the abuse, we know the sorrow that is caused when you have women who don't don't get it okay. Again, and whether it can't be a major part of our community.
Okay, I think first we'll have Rabbi Weissman for it to answer the first and third parts of the question, and then Rabbi Jordan will take it.
Okay, I don't disagree with you about starting education early. Middle school might be pushing it a little, but certainly high school is not too early an age to educate. And I think historically we have spoken over the years in high schools, not just on college campuses, but I agree with you. I think that's a worthwhile endeavor to try to expand our program to speaking to high school age students. In terms of the third point, I don't think the Rabbinical Council of America, of all organizations, can be faulted. They've been at front and center of this effort. They've passed numerous resolutions over the years. We do have to keep our attention on this issue. We have to continually remind rabbis and make sure that this is a matter of priority to them. The RCA has been helpful in that regard, but we can never, you know, stop fighting the fight and making sure that, to the extent possible, we let people know about this agreement and its importance.
Rabbi Henkin's proposal to authorize again at the time of marriage doesn't survive as a matter of Jewish law the bitterness of divorce. This stands in contrast with, even if it's signed out of love, there'll be a period prior to divorce where there's far from love. Rabbi Herzog's observation that you can sign such an agreement and go off to war, even if there's intimacy between these two, is because there's never any situation where divorce is contemplated. So I think those two situations are not at all analogous, not necessarily in terms of how they're viewed at the moment of signing, but the husband will nullify the authorization to give his wife a get once divorce is apparent, and that's in fact what pushes Rabbi Henkin to retract, whereas Rabbi Herzog's proposal assumes that the husband more or less dies on the battlefield and his body is not recovered. It's a not analogous situation because presumably the whole marriage in Rabbi Herzog's case was with love.
Thank you.
Thank you. Two quick questions. One is the prenup specifies the President of America, but what if the couple decides at some point they want to use different medicine, or they moved away, and it's not so convenient, they don't live in New York, they move to Israel, to some other distant location. Is there a provision for some other medicine to be used, and if so, what kind of medicine? That's the first question. And the second one is with regard to all kinds of alternate lifestyles, where you have sometimes women supporting their husbands, or a situation where they live on a very low income, like the Kolo family, and $150 a week is something that, a day, that is something that in many years is inconceivable. Do you have provision for situations like that?
One of the advantages of being called the Besdin of America is that it's a Besdin that actually can, in certain cases, serve the entire country. And there were a number of cases where parties signed an arbitration agreement before the Besdin, lived elsewhere and moved elsewhere, where the Besdin would actually send the panel to hear the case, whether it's out west or in the Midwest, even cases heard in North America. So the fact that parties aren't living in New York does not necessarily make it prohibitive for the Besdin to hear the case. But if parties should decide that they want a different Besdin to hear a case, parties can always stipulate the name of that other Besdin in the actual arbitration agreement, or they can sign a subsequent arbitration agreement in which they agree to go to a different Besdin. In cases where parties go to other jurisdictions outside of the United States, outside of North America, there are certain other forms, other types of prenuptial agreements that meet the requirements of those other jurisdictions. There's even a form that has been promulgated in Israel. And in individual cases, parties can consult with the Bezin of America as to how to acquire the appropriate forms. With respect to your second question, what was the second question again? The couple. Our experience has been, I think Rabbi Boyd mentioned earlier, that he never found a a wealthy couple that was so wealthy that the amount of the prenuptial agreement was in any way insufficient in order to provoke the husband to comply with respect to the bezdin and the get proceeding rather than pay the amount of money. I find that it works the other direction as well. Sometimes, even though a husband might make very little amount of money, it might not actually have any assets at all in which to pay the amount of the obligation of the prenuptial agreement. So you might think then it's also not much of an incentive because he doesn't have any money to pay. Most people don't want a debt on their record that's going to be potentially collected at some future point in time, and they would rather comply rather than have that debt pile up. And in terms of whether the standard of living can be adjusted for the situation where the husband really doesn't make so much money, the answer is yes. In situations where $150 is not accurate, it could be adjusted down to $100 or whatever the case may be. But by and large, in terms of the realities of contemporary life, even those who do not have a very high standard of living end up paying a substantial amount of money just to make ends meet.
I think the question you raised was generally the importance of educating our community about Beis Din procedure, about the way that a Beis Din differs from civil court adjudication. That's something that's at the forefront of our agenda. We have a website that's certainly improved over the past few years. We're consistently trying to think of ways to get the word out about educating people about the processes and the procedures that we use. We just started up a joint program with Yeshiva University's Kollel for Dayanus, where we hope to, in the future, in the near future, publish journals that will get the word out. So this is all something that is on our agenda, and I think something of critical importance to the community. And it does, as you say, go hand in hand with advertising the importance of the prenup.
I wanted to know why the issue of Avona regarding the RCA is not in line with similar things. As a brief example, I don't think that a member would be able to remain in good standing in the RCA if he was officiating in a shul that didn't have a machitza, or there were other clear violations of halacha. It seems that with the advent of the Rabbi Willis prenuptial agreement, that there's a solution, and if the RCA if all graduates from Reeds, in order to be a graduate of good standing, had to use the prenuptial, if we made it something that was compulsory, as a member in good standing of YU, Reeds, whatever organization that they're going to want to be affiliated with, that's what you have to do. It seems that there's a solution. So I would like to respectfully ask the rabbis what's holding back implementation.
I think that we have to promote as much as possible the use of the prenuptial agreement, and we have to push as much as possible for a community consensus that this is something that everybody should do. So in that sense, I think that your point is correct, that part of the responsibility of being a rabbi when one officiates at a kiddushin is to ensure that there won't be problems down the road, that all appropriate steps are taken in order to ensure that there not be an aguna situation, that there be a framework in place that will be able to address a potential problem that might arise. And in my experience, the reality is that the use of the prenuptial agreement in every single case in which there was a divorce and a potential problem, and the prenuptial agreement had been signed by the couple, the get was given in a timely fashion. I don't think that rabbis need any greater proof than that as a clear indication that part of their rabbinic responsibility is to utilize this type of agreement when they officiated a wedding.
My understanding and my experience, the situation is that if a husband is willing to give a get, that rabbis, and I had this experience, there were many rabbis that would not give the get until the civil divorce was completed because, halakhically, apparently, if the husband comes to feel uncomfortable with the way the civil divorce went, and he comes to regret that he gave the get, that the get, is no longer valid. Halakhically.
Is that a question?
It's a statement. I just wonder.
Okay, which we're trying to keep it. Right. So, Roy will comment. He'll put a question mark at the end.
It's a question. What are you willing to do about that?
I think a validly given get, given before a civil divorce, after a civil divorce, or in a situation in which there is no civil marriage, is valid, and that there is no. There is no defect in such a get, and that when a husband and wife come to the Bezdin of America without any coercion to give a get, without any coercion to receive a get, and the get is given, the get is valid.
But that's logically incorrect.
Let me stop then. I don't know a lot of Jewish law, but I actually don't believe I'm at all incorrect here. Okay, there is no question that a get when validly given with the free will of the husband and the wife is valid as a matter of Jewish law.
Yes?
Going back to my lawyer's discussion about the term of the marriage, he said it had to be something that had you known about it, had to exist before, and had you known about it, you wouldn't have married the person. But it seems to me that when two religious people get married, each assumes that the other will continue to follow halakha. And if a beis din gives a get or requires a get, and the person refuses to give it, he's not following halakha. Why can we say that had she known this, this was an error that existed pre-marriage, and therefore could be used to invalidate the marriage?
That's a great question, and it's very important to understand the answer. People change, and when a husband and a wife marry, and they both agree that they're going to obey Jewish law, and subsequently one of them decides they're not going to obey Jewish law, that doesn't void the marriage, that defect does not exist at the time of the marriage. Well, again, let me say differently. If you were to show me that the husband had written before they were married, that although he says he's going to obey Jewish law, he already understands that he's not going to, that might be a defect. But when a husband and wife marry, and after many years of marriage, one of them changes, the fact that the other one says, I never would have married you had I understood that you were going to change in this way, does not void the marriage. People change in the course of their marriage in ways that their spouse doesn't like. Maybe that's not sad. Maybe that's just the way it is. It's hard to marry in perpetuity and stay the way you are when you're 21. And that doesn't void a marriage when a person does something after many years of marriage that had their spouse known as they were eventually going to do subsequently. That doesn't void a marriage. Otherwise, every single person's marriage would be void because all of us, maybe not all of us, many of us have made choices in our marriage that, in fact, are different from the choices we made when we got married at a much younger age. Not me.
Thank you. I have so many questions, but I'll focus on the natural agreement. Just want to make two remarks about it. One is that we have to be fully aware that it does not help any of the, whether it's hundreds or thousands of women who didn't sign a prenup for in their 30s and 40s or 50s or whatever it might be. The second thing is with regard to...
Excuse me, I'm sorry to cut you off.
Yes.
Being that we're just a limited amount of time, and a lot of people want to ask. No. Just leave it to questions.
Oh, the question.
Okay.
How much did it cost for the woman to enforce her prenup in Amsterdam, and how often do women have that prenup of resources? And second of all, the number of times that a PNA was invoked, I'd like to know. The time that elapsed, in general, on the gas, the shortest and the longest, how long after the invocation did the woman actually get her get? Because I heard last week and this week, no later than the civil divorce, before the civil divorce, or in a timely way. And how many women have received the financial compensation that is due to them when the time elapses between the demand for the get and the actual delivery of the get? Do they get the $125 a day? I know of one case.
Does anyone know the factual answers to the questions? Anybody? No? Can you? If no one knows, it's also an answer.
In the case in the Netherlands, I don't know the woman's legal bill, but she obviously employed a lawyer to assist her in the civil divorce, the way that anybody going through a civil divorce process would typically employ a lawyer. I don't know that the lawyer charged anything extra to enforce this agreement. As far as the general timetable for the prenuptial agreements, our experience has been that in pretty much all the cases that I can recall, don't know if this is every case, it was generally prior to the civil divorce that the get was given. If it was not prior to the civil divorce, it certainly would not have been any material amount of time afterwards. And the time frame from when a prenuptial agreement is raised with a Besdin and when the case has been resolved has been anywhere from a couple of days to 6 months to a year. As far as the question of whether a woman has collected, the answer is yes. We know of cases where the money has been collected.
Thank you.
Hi. I guess in the interest of time, I won't mention it, but I can think of several powerful reasons why a postnuptial agreement could be, as a community response, much more powerful than a prenup. Is there any intrinsic reason why you can't make it? Obviously, you have to change it from the date of the signing to the date of the marriage, but why this prenup can't be designed to get couples who are already married to agree in the future to follow these terms?
Very good.
Postnups are a wonderful idea as a matter of theory. Everybody should sign them. It's a good thing to do. There are some technical American contract law considerations that might make postnups difficult to enforce in some states. It has something to do with common law consideration, and it would take me too long to explain the details of the contract law here as to why that's the case. But certainly everybody should be encouraged to sign not just the prenup, but those who haven't. Should sign postnups. It certainly can't hurt, and it perhaps could help in many situations, and it's a good idea.
In Riverdale, we had a postnup meeting, and I signed it myself.
Yeah, 18 and a half years ago, I gave my wife a gift. If there are any Agunas here in this audience now, or if you know someone's in a Aguna, I can help you. Even if they don't have a prenuptial, or even if they do have a prenuptial. I've been successful before. I'm going to help anyone. I have a, please, I mean, speak to me afterwards.
Next.
I want to go back to the question of the lady before. I think get before a civil divorce is not good. I think there's another thing involved here. We have it also in the Shir. We would like people who are divorced not to meet a lot afterwards. So you make a get, you're going to meet her 10 times in court. But that's not a big problem because you don't meet her alone. But you should, that some people like to have it as close as possible together. If there's no problem, so you shouldn't meet the woman too often. What happens if you have to, the woman has the children, I'm not from here, that's why my English is not so good. The woman has the children, the husband picks up, I heard like some Haredim, the husband went to pick up his children from his ex-wife's house, they might just be together for a few minutes. Is there such a a thing that you have to be careful about or not?
Sort of a follow-up on your question.
You want to take it?
It's half a follow-up. We'll give you
okay, since the follow-up... Look, a husband and wife who have been divorced who are intimate with the intent of remarrying are remarried. We have a policy which discourages husbands and wives after they've been divorced from spending an inordinate amount of time together and certainly from any post-divorce sexuality. These issues don't question the validity of the get that's been given, although of course these are issues that require some sensitivity, and you have to realize there are children frequently and they have to get along for the sake of the children. But of course, these are pastoral matters, and again, I want to go back to the statement that I said before. Even if a husband and wife give a get and receive a get before a civil divorce, the get is valid even if one of them regrets it, and even if the husband and the wife exchange children in the wife's apartment, that doesn't undermine the validity of the subsequent get. It would require... I'm sorry? The previous get, I'm sorry. It would require a much more serious type of an interaction to raise any questions about whether the couple has remarried. Exchanging children wouldn't ring that bell.
I'm just wondering if the couple signs an agreement that they should handle child custody matters, and then one of the parties is no longer firm or is no longer Jewish, will the courts generally uphold what the Mason decides on child custody?
One of you two.
I would answer the question by saying that the standard employed by the Beis Din in deciding these difficult and sensitive matters is just about identical to the standard employed by the court, and that is the best interests of the child. That means that, generally speaking, where a child grew up in a frum household and one spouse is no longer frum, that might affect schedule of visitation. It might affect the appropriateness of, for example, when Shabbos visits take place. The opposite is also true. If a child grew up in a secular home, and now all of a sudden one spouse is fervently religious, the way that the child was accustomed throughout his childhood to be raised might affect the way the Beis Din schedules visitation. It might make Shabbos visits less appropriate, for example. And I would venture to guess that courts probably approach that question in the same type of way. So again, it's the best interest of the child that's ultimately going to be the determinant of any type of decision coming out of the Beis Din.
And just, we're running a little low on time. We'll try to get one or two more questions in.
Sorry, I'm a little late, so I'm not sure if you addressed this or not, but I was curious that most college teachers have a curriculum set by some rabbi, and most women don't take the Messiah Kedushin. Usually that's the man, and the man, often the Messiah Kedushin is the chassan teacher, etc. I was wondering if there's a lot of educational programming done toward the kala teachers to promote that the kalas bring up the prenup and encourage them to sign a prenup, etc.
I'd love to answer your question with armed with firm knowledge. Unfortunately, I do not have firm knowledge. I know some kala teachers do bring up the prenup, and some don't. And as part of our general education, we should encourage kala teachers to bring it up and encourage kalas to go to those kala teachers.
Yes.
Yes. If somebody signs a monetary prenuptial, a secular monetary prenuptial agreement, which excludes certain income or assets from previous time, does the Beis Din of America take this into account as being, a halachically legal agreement, and do they try to enforce any changes in it?
According to the rules and procedures of the Beis Din of America, the Beis Din of America will honor any contract that was entered into between parties to the fullest extent permitted by Jewish law. So to the degree that Jewish law does allow husbands and wives to enter into certain contractual arrangements regarding how money is going to be allocated and who will be entitled to what assets, that is certainly something which the Beit Din of America would take into consideration. In fact, even the prenuptial agreement that was discussed earlier by Rabbi Willig provides for an option for parties to stipulate that when the Beit Din of America adjudicates monetary issues at the conclusion of their marriage, that it will apply notions of equitable distribution that are consistent with generally accepted norms within the secular law and practice.
This is Harara. I'm early on in your first very interesting work about preservation. You mentioned early on in your presentation one of the members of the Beis Din going up to the lawyer for the guy and saying, listen, you know, there seems to be trade here, and you got up and said that's absolute checker. Is that gentleman still on the Beis Din, and or has he had an attitude adjustment? I'm sorry, lawyer. Okay, maybe I misunderstood your
right. No, that's quite all right. I'm happy to clarify. I was not discussing an actual diet, an actual judge at the Beis Din. I was discussing an interaction with a rabbinic advocate, and it's not for the purpose of getting into specific personalities, but simply to mention the types of statements and misconceptions that sometimes get mentioned in these matters, and how important it is to clarify these types of misconceptions.
Okay. I think this is the last question, please.
Thank you. Rabbi Willig, in his statements, discussed the Yoshish reservations about Asmachta. It wasn't clear to me if this would affect the union of Get Rosa or not. Is it completely independent of Get Rosa, or does it affect?
That is a very learned question. And given the time that's allowed, I'm not able to answer it fully. Suffice it to say that that our prenuptial agreement has been around for a long time, and Rabbi Yosha was undoubtedly aware of it and has not made any statements which would indicate in any way that he views a get given in the shadow of a prenup to be a get ma'usa. One can explain that in 10 different ways, but I think we have a measure of confidence given the caliber of the rabbinical signatories on this document, and that has not really been opposed forcefully by the Rabbanim who are deciding these matters for the community at large, that a person can feel confident that a prenup in place and a get given as a result of the prenup will have the validity that is required, that there should be no problem in either the woman remarrying and no problem with the children as well.
One more question? Yes. Last question.
Being somewhat new to this, I just would like to clarify three definitions, if I may. The first one would be asmachta. So I understood it to mean to be aligned with intention when you do something. The definition. But I am of the impression that any contract you sign will involve some future clause that might or might not happen. You buy a house with an immediate transfer of property and money, but you also have conditions of future delinquency on one part or the other one. So what actually is the meaning of asmachta? That's the first thing. The second thing is the word coercion. I also don't understand that, because I would assume that coercion means no choice. But even in those acts which we consider coercion, punishment or feeding, there is some choice. I mean, you might be beaten up, you still not give a gift. On the other hand, something like a demonstration or pressure, or the demonstration outside of the business, let's say, could also be considered pressure. So I don't follow the definitions of these words. And the one last thing is the get itself, because you get a civil divorce, so it means that you have settled the issues. So I don't quite understand the getting of the get before the settling of the issue. Is there something different there?
I think I'm going to take this one and saying that was far too good of a question. meaning that the time that it will take for any of these panel members to answer it is going to go way beyond our time. So I think I have agreement that anybody will be happy to talk afterwards, and we'll take them there. I'm sorry not to answer this one, but we are over time already. People have to go. And those were not simple questions by any stretch of the imagination, so therefore we're going to have to hold off on that.
Okay, just as a final matter, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us this morning. Your presence here is appreciated, and I hope that you learned something about it.